Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
And this week, we're continuing conversations that began at Stanford at the Stanford Humanities Center, co-sponsor of today's show. Our thanks to John Bender and all the wonderful staff at the Humanities Center. Our guest, Stephen Meyer, was a fellow there and returned to participate this last weekend in a glorious conference about knowledge and belief, celebrating the Humanities Center's 25th anniversary at Stanford.
Yeah, it's a fine place, the Humanities Center. And this conversation that started down at the Stanford on the Stanford campus has migrated to the air, obviously, and it's already migrated to the blog where both John Perry and our chief researcher, head of our crack research team, Neil Van Leeuwen, have already weighed in on the blog, so go check it out at theblog.philosophytalk.org.
Well, Ken, since you mentioned the blog, let's get into today's topic, art and the suspension of disbelief, with a little story I told on my blog. When Charles Dickens killed off Little Nell in the old curiosity shop, thousands of people lined up at the docks on New York City waiting for the edition of the paper that had that installment in there. They were worried that something was going to happen to Little Nell. And when the people closest to the boat ripped open the package and read the thing, and then they told the people behind them, and they told the people behind them that Little Nell had died. People just wept and wailed and threw themselves on the ground. And there was this fantastic outpouring of emotion, and yet Little Nell wasn't real, and everybody knew she wasn't real. Isn't that kind of amazing?
It's pretty. Yeah, it's really amazing because, right, they knew she wasn't real. So, who were they concerned about? Little Nell is a fictional character. She's not a real person. I mean, so how could they even have emotions about Little Nell? Right. I mean, that's one question. And if they did have emotions about Little Nell, why did they move them like that? Why did they cause them to wail on the ground and all that? Because, you know, when you watch a horror movie, you're afraid, but you don't run out of the theater. I mean, these guys seem confused.
Well, yeah, but although, you know, some of Dickens' fellow authors, like Carlyle, who presumably wasn't at all confused about the reality of Little Nell, wrote him a letter saying what a jerk he was for killing her. So he had anger. It was real anger, even though it was a fiction and he knew it.
But he was angry. Carlyle sounds like he was angry or disappointed or something at Dickens rather than whoever in the story killed Little Nell, right?
Well,
that's
that
a little
be.
Different thing. This is complicated stuff. But, you know, so there's a puzzle, right? There's a big puzzle about this stuff. Art, movies, novels, anything that tells a story moves us emotionally, deeply moves us. Often it's just pure make-believe. It's completely made up. Are the emotions real? Well, if they were real, why don't they cause us to run out of the theater or, like, go get a gun to save the woman who's about to be killed, you know? I mean, that's a real puzzle, I think.
Well, when we have children that are about to run out of the theater or break into tears or go too far in getting upset, we remind them that it's not real. So maybe there's kind of I guess this is what the willing suspension of disbelief that we hear about is.
Right.
There's kind of this intermediate state where your belief that it's not real or your disbelief that it is real is somehow put on hold. And then you can pull it back when you're about to run out of the theater or, you know, soil your pants.
Just
or
in the nick of time, you face the reality that it's a mere fiction. So the willing suspension of disbelief is supposed to be a solution to a puzzle. Our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, went out and talked to some people who engaged in the suspension of disbelief. She files this report.
Why is it that sometimes things that aren't real affect us as if we were right there, having that experience ourselves? I asked a few people I know to describe the movie, the book, the video game that made them lose track of the difference between reality and fiction.
Superman will have just done some heroic thing, and he'll come back and he'll put back on his nerdy clothes and look like Clark Kent, and Lois Lane will be there, and she has no idea what he's just done, and she treats him like a schmuck. It just kills me to watch this, and I know every time I watch it, I know what's going to happen. I know that she's not going to appreciate this great thing he's done, and that she's going to treat him like a loser. But it still pains me to see it. I always find myself just wishing, just once this time I watch it, that he would just sort of break out of character and tell her the truth.
So Tyrion Lannister, a dwarf, hunchback dwarf, is lying on a stone cell at the edge of a cliff. He's hungry, he's cold, he's lacking in any kind of comfort. His jailer has been coming in and beating him and throwing his food off the side of the cliff. And Tyrion is scared, but he's cunning, so he's figuring out how to get out of this situation. I was reading this book, and a friend of mine told me that she had never seen me so concentrated, including when I've been working or doing anything else, which is a little ironic because it's a fantasy novel, you know, large, thick, trashy fantasy novel. My focus really goes on this Tyrion Lannister, how he's going to get out of this bind that he's in.
It was so fun. It's like one of those sort of Doom-style games where you run around in an arena, kind of, and you run out of your ammo, and sometimes it comes down to hand-to-hand combat, which is really funny. But I was screaming uncontrollably and stamping my feet, and just, like, the tension of what was happening in the game was so overwhelming. It just felt so real.
It's about a man who can time travel, but not in the sense that as we know it, he's got some genetic disorder, which means that his body just shifts through time, quite physically. He can suddenly be in another place, not know why he's there, where he is, and he always appears naked. And he says to her before he dies, "I will see you again. You will see me one more time." She's always hoping, she's always looking out of the window. And she does see him again, because he traveled back before he died. And it just gives you goosebumps. I cried a lot when I read it. Yes, I cried buckets, just absolutely sobbing for about 2 or 3 hours after I'd finished it. You just feel as though it was an experience you went through and you know them. You feel as though you've made friends.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks for that piece, Amy. People shedding buckets of tears over fictional entities. The first guy seemed to imply that Superman isn't real. Is that right, Ken?
Yeah, well, I hate to break it to you, John, but I think that's right. Oh, Superman isn't real. Neither is Santa Claus, by the way. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my colleague John Perry, and we're joined today by Stephen Meyer, who's a Associate Professor of English from Washington University in St. Louis. He's author of Irresistible Dictation, Gertrude Stein and the Correlations of Writing and Science. Stephen, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm delighted to be here.
Stephen, you're not just a philosopher, you're an English professor. You guys know about these things. Why do people cry at movies?
Why do they cry at movies? Well, we're proposing to talk today about suspension of disbelief, and the strange thing there, obviously, is that they're crying in movies because they seem to be believing something. Right. So why is this disbelief when they are, in fact, so into the event that they don't seem to be able to distinguish between reality and fiction?
Is that how you set it up? You think that somebody cries at a movie or cries at the reading of a novel because they mistakenly take it to be real? They believe they don't know the difference between reality and fiction?
Right. That's how we actually often think about it. That's how it appears to us. But then Coleridge proposed that something else is going on, and that, in fact, instead of believing something, it's enough to suspend disbelief.
How's that work? Help me. Take me through this a little bit. And so I'm watching a movie.
Yeah.
You know, something really sad going on. I think, oh, come on, it's just a movie.
And you may say that in defense, that is not wanting to break out into sobs. So you break out of the appearance. But in fact, although you know, and you never don't know that there's a screen there and these are just images and these are not real people and they're actors, you in fact allow yourself to ignore this fact. And that's suspending disbelief.
Aren't there really two levels of facts we need to ignore? Last night I saw Goodbye and Goodnight, the kind of semi-documentary about Edward R. Murrow. So most of the things depicted there were intended to be depictions of actual events. I was supposed to believe that the events occurred, but I still didn't believe that the images on the screen were real. When I see a movie that's a fictional movie, then I'm supposed to suspend disbelief, I'm supposed to think that what's depicted is real. But do I have to suspend belief that I'm only seeing a representation, pictures on a screen? Doesn't seem like I suspend belief in that. Suspend disbelief in that, does it?
Well, I mean, it seems to me it works at both levels and in different works more and less complexly. So that, you know, when you're watching some great movie, and it's all fiction, and maybe derived from a novel, and you're watching the characters, you're thinking of the characters. You're not thinking this is an actor playing this character, even though it's a fictional character. You're thinking, you know, this person, what is happening here?
Well, but if we have a general theory, it should apply to the stage. That's one extreme. But how about just reading a book? Nobody confuses the print in a book with real characters, or is under any illusion they're doing anything but reading a book.
Let me give you an example to press John's point further, Stephen. Okay. Look, suppose that I'm watching a play, right? And the most sympathetic character is about to be run over by a train. And I think, my God, she's going to be run over by a train. I don't run on the stage and stop the train. Even if I could run on the stage and stop the train. I mean, even if I did run on the stage and tried to stop the fake train, there would be something really weird about that, right? So I'm sad, but, you know, my sadness doesn't move me. You said you're just thinking about the characters. Well, yeah, sort of. You are thinking about the characters, but there also seems to be, you know, you're watching a play. Yeah,
in this middle state, and so you're not disbelieving. That is, but you're not believing either. It's this peculiar position that you're in. And the classic example is, you know, of somebody who fails to do this is precisely the guy who says, don't kill her, about Desdemona or something on the stage, and rushes. He's not stopping a train. It's easier to stop a knife, you think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And has ruined the play. For
right,
everybody.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
There's seldom realistic trains on the stage, but it can be realistic.
Yeah.
And people often do have, you know, the beginnings of that reaction, and sometimes people break out when there's a suspense is built up, and they say, watch out! Mm-hmm. But, we usually are able to call back to unsuspend our disbelief long enough to keep from making utter fools of ourselves.
Some philosophers say, well, you know, in one sense, you're not really sad that the heroine is about to be run over by the play. You have the phenomenology as of sadness, but you're not really sad. Because if you were really sad and you believed you could do something about it and all that, you act in a certain way. And you don't act. I mean, the sadness doesn't move you to act in the ways that kind of real sadness does. You have the kind of feeling, the kind of appearance of sadness without real sadness. Some people call that kind of art sadness. I mean, what do you think? Yeah. I mean, do movies not cause genuine emotions in us, but something like the appearance of emotion?
Well,
or
I mean,
art or other representation? Or,
I mean, the example of Nell, that seems to be people who had real sadness and were really, truly upset. On the other hand, often when you're out of the frame, you cease to be sad. And so in the movie, when you suddenly are sobbing, is this real tears? You know, it seems to be.
If you think about those people that went to the docks, this was, you know, in the middle of the 19th century. They probably had to step over some little pauper girls selling flowers on the way, and they didn't let those engage their emotions. There is something kind of fakey about it, but I'm not sure I'm totally on top of what it is.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this is interesting. I'm really puzzled. I mean, you might say about the Dickens people who are waiting eagerly for the fate of Nell that they suffered from a confusion. They're kind of like the guy sitting in the theater thinking, oh, my God, she's going to be run over. Let me save her. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, Nell's died. Let me go into utter despair.
On the other hand, they're just waiting for the book. That is at the theater. They're not waiting for an actual person. They're waiting to find out what happens.
Yeah, presumably if somebody had come to the edge of the boat and thrown a small child overboard, they would have jumped in and tried to save her.
Right.
But only because they're so primed for it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is art and the suspension of disbelief. Our guest, Stephen Meyer.
We've been talking about this suspension of disbelief or pretense involved in the enjoyment of fiction. How far can it be pushed? Superman? Well, that's pretty far. But how about a man with no dimensions or the time traveler? Can we really get into that kind of fiction? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The number is 415-841-4134, and we want to hear from you.
We'll take your calls, and we'll hear more about the suspension of disbelief when Philosophy Talk continues. Ooh.
is only a paper moon hanging over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me. It is only a canvas sky sailing over a muslin tree. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played on a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me.
Nat King Cole, the mellifluous Nat King Cole, with It's Only a Paper Moon. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing art and the suspension of disbelief. Have you ever experienced a novel, I'm sure you have, that you just couldn't put down, or a movie you couldn't stop watching, you couldn't turn away from? What sucked you into that reality? Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
And if you're outside the Bay Area, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. And finally, from anywhere around the world listening to us on the net, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And let me repeat, comments. Don't push any other buttons. Push the comments button, comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Stephen Meyer from Washington University in St. Louis. So, Steve, I want to ask you, look, sometimes I'm watching a movie or reading a novel, and I'm gripped by it, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, come on, this is unbelievable. This is silly. This is crap. And it just loses me. So sometimes, you know, the fake isn't like fake enough or something. I don't know. Something like that. So what constrains, you know, how far we'll go? What determines how far we'll go in suspending disbelief in doing this thing?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that'll do it is sort of generic. It's like there's certain things you can do in a particular realistic novel that you can't do in a science fiction work and vice versa. And so you can get away with certain things and suddenly you stop and you say, it's fake. You know, this is not satisfying. This is, I can't stay in it. Because the thing about suspension of disbelief is you don't quite believe it, but you're in it. And there are things that jar you. There are things that just suddenly you're in your own skin, you're in your own life, and you're no longer in the story or in the occasion.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because in some ways, in some sense, you're never in the story, in some sense. A philosopher named Kendall Walton makes a nice distinction. He says, look, the world of the fiction, we're physically removed from it, usually, right? But we're psychologically engaged from it. We can't affect the world of the fiction. And in some ways, you know, the falling boulders or whatever in the movie aren't going to fall on us, right? So we're physically removed, but psychologically, we're like deeply. Oh, and, you know, the falling boulders. Oh, my God.
Oh, completely. Or like there was that guy on the lead who was saying, you know, won't Superman break out a character and tell her the truth? And he actually, the fact that Superman won't, right, is pleasurable in some way, even though it's frustrating. It's also, whereas in real life, you want the guy to tell the truth, and if he doesn't tell the truth, then that's a problem.
I do think, though, that we shouldn't forget about history. That is, the psychological removal doesn't just occur with fiction. The psychological connection in the face of physical removal. We can't do much about the past, but we can be quite moved by histories. So there seem to be two problems. First, the fact that we're just seeing a representation or reading representation, and secondly, that what the representation we're reading about is unreal. With history, we have the first, but not the second. With fiction, we have both. And yet, we can probably get more easily sucked into fiction than history.
Why is that, right? That's the chief question. One reason that might happen is that we're getting something out of the process. We're actually finding out something new.
Well, now, one of our old friends, Pete in San Francisco, has sent us an email that ties into that. He says, is the banality of contemporary life a possible reason for our capacity to have an intense emotional response to fiction? If people lived engaged, active lives in the natural world, rather than drone existence in corporate campuses, and he says corporate campuses.
Because he's thinking about Stanford, huh?
No, he doesn't. Same on you, Pete. He doesn't say college campuses, where, of course, we're engaged up to our necks in real life, right? But corporate campuses like Microsoft, would they be less likely to respond emotionally to fictional works? That is, does fiction fill a need that's created by our drab existence?
Well, that seems to be partly the case. I mean, because what happens with suspension of disbelief is that it allows you to have an experience that you might not otherwise have. And if you're not having many experiences you're pleased with, it gives you a richer life. You know, again, it's clearly what happened with Nell there, that people could, the richness of the experience, whereas they can't have a rich experience with a little girl on the street.
I, as I recall, Coleridge, who coined the term suspension of disbelief, coined it in the context of some controversy with Wordsworth about what poetry should be like or something like that, because Coleridge's poetry was fantastical and magical, and Wordsworth thought it should be more about the everyday or something like that. And so his point about what poetry is and the suspension of disbelief was very much connected to this, that there's a kind of poetry that's magical, that's mysterious, that takes you way beyond. And a key to enjoying that is the suspension of disbelief.
And the only way you can appreciate that magical work is if you don't actually take it seriously, in the sense that you're thinking this had to have actually happened. You have to be able to get to that point.
Still, it's kind of amazing the lengths we can go to continue with our theme. Take Kafka's The Metamorphoses, where you're asked to suspend disbelief in the idea that you're not a beetle, or that this guy isn't a beetle. Or more recently, Philip Roth's The Breast, where a man turns into a female breast. I mean, people, that was a bestseller. So is it just, are those experiences that we've kind of missed out on in daily life and want to experience? I don't think so.
We may not have known we wanted to experience them.
Yeah.
All right. Or we may not have admitted we wanted to experience them.
Yeah, in the case of the breast, I had never had that particular fantasy until Philip Roth came along.
Mark in San Francisco's on the line. Mark, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for taking my call. I just had a comment about feeling the emotions, particularly, say, at a movie, that maybe we're bringing the emotions with us, and it's an emotion that we don't feel safe expressing outside the movie, but in the safe environment, it allows us, something triggers that emotion in us, that it allows us to express it and feel it at that time in a safer environment.
Well, Mark, I think you're really on to something there, at least in my own case. I think my existence is probably pretty drab as things go, but I have plenty of occasions where tears would be appropriate, but I very seldom break into tears, but at sad movies, I almost always do. So I do think there's kind of that emotion buildup that somehow in the darkness of the movie theater and with the fact that you're projecting them onto some fictional case, they're released. It's a very interesting point you make.
What do you think, Stephen?
And it also, I mean, it seems to be consistent, John, what you were saying about your experience of the Truman Capote novel, where you were there.
This is in the blog, by the way, if you folks haven't read it, but go ahead.
Yeah, but you were there, and yet you experience it more fully, and reading about it in a fictional fact work, and it's precisely because somehow it's a safer space. You're not suddenly having to be caught up with all the things that happen around you.
So that's a part of this this thing that some philosophers worry about. What kind of emotions are these? Since they don't have their normal effects, right? They have kind of normal causes, not exactly, because it's not real stuff, but it's representations of stuff. They don't have the normal effects. You don't change your life. You don't get up and run out of the theater. You don't weep for the rest of the day, for the rest of your life, in despair over the death. But this space to rehearse the emotions. Mm-hmm. I mean, art provides you a space in which you may rehearse the emotions without having their full consequences. Jenny in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jenny.
Hi, my name is Jeannie.
Jeannie, okay.
Thanks. Well, I think your previous caller a little bit took my thunder. I'm a psychotherapist, and I know that, you know, movies and books can help people experience emotions that maybe haven't actually found expression in the real world, and it can be cathartic in a way. I mean, like, I often watch ER because I know I'll probably cry over it. And I know that I'm crying about something in my own life, and so it is real.
So you agree with the last caller, but you're coming at it from a sort of a professional point of view. You find that this is often helpful in thinking about other people's cases?
Well, yeah. I mean, we all need to develop empathy in order to be able to understand what goes on with other people and to care about other people and their difficulties. And so it is, you know, part of our humanity. Sometimes people don't have strong empathy developed. And sometimes watching movies, there are some therapists who sometimes recommend, there's something, you know, it's kind of like a movie therapy, and recommend certain films to help people get in touch with feelings.
Kind of training in being human.
Thanks for the call, Steve. That reminds me. Look, I think I'm not sure about the view that when you're watching a movie or reading a novel that the emotions you feel are more like the appearance of an emotion rather than the full real thing. But it seems to me whether or not you think that, I mean, it's still an exercise of having the emotions kind of divorced from the total consequences. It still could be transfer that experience, lessons learned from that experience to...
Well, you can. I mean, that's the key thing there is the kind of divorced, right? It's this not fully divorced. And it's the emotion may not be quite the same thing because it's in a somewhat different context, but you may be able, in fact, it may have consequences, right? It may have consequences that you can't predict in advance. And therefore, you may, in fact, change subtly as a result of this.
We've got two emails that are both strike a similar chord. First is from Nick in my old hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska. He says, could imagination connect emotion to emotion in a manner that bypasses formal rationality? Maybe the willing suspension of disbelief allows us to identify with the drama and interaction of desire and hope with moral and natural evil. Then Stephen Upjohn asks about dreaming. He says, your discussion reminds me of dreaming. My 17-year-old cat recently died. Too bad, Stephen. And I have had several dreams of him since. In each dream I knew I was dreaming. I knew that Boogie had died, yet I stayed and petted him and told him I loved him. I also have a common dream in which my teeth are falling out. Boy, I've had that one. It is so common that now when I have it, I know I'm dreaming and try to wake myself up. Last year I broke a tooth and tried to wake myself up, but it didn't work. Do you think the ability to suspend disbelief is somehow related to our capacity to dream?
Absolutely. I mean, again, this is precisely what Coleridge was working with the supernatural experiences and one thing I just want to say here is that whereas the notion originally emerged to describe poetry, it in fact has proven useful and continues in all sorts of other art forms. In fact, people don't tend to talk about poetry now. The first thing they talk about are films or fiction and so on and so forth. But when you take it back to the poetry, the connection to dream is much clearer.
Yeah, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about art and the suspension of disbelief with our guest Stephen Meyer of Washington University in St. Louis. And we'd love to have your calls. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. If you're in the Bay Area, that's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And Miriam in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Miriam.
Hi, thanks for taking my phone call.
Well, what's your question or comment? Shoot.
Well, I had a comment about, it's along the same lines as the past two callers. I agreed with them that I don't feel like the emotions that are felt are false emotions. And there's a point brought up of not wanting to run on the stage and save somebody. But I think that has more to do with the disconnection, the fact that the audience member realizes that they can't do anything because, and it's similar when you see a car crash and there's emergency personnel on the side of the road and you know that, you know, you in your car can't do anything to save them or to help them and that they're already being helped. So, you know.
That's a good point. So it's not just suspending the disbelief, it's also suspending the proneness towards action. And as you point out, that sometimes occurs where you don't suspend the disbelief. I want to connect up with something our emailer said. We were talking about the limits to the suspension of disbelief. And if you think about dreams, it seems there aren't many limits because dreams and poetry can really be quite incoherent. Maybe we don't feel the emotions because maybe an emotion is a combination of a feeling and a belief, and we don't have the right belief. But boy, the feelings you get in dreams, particularly the kind that wake you up screaming, seem like pretty real feelings.
And that has to do probably in part because things that are being juxtaposed, massively juxtaposed, which is the source of much emotional experience when things go together that you normally don't think of as going together, and yet somehow they feel like they should go together. And it's that feeling they should go together that happens so easily in dreams because you're suspending disbelief.
Stephen, I want to ask you about it. Miriam, thanks for the call. You brought up with some interesting points. But Stephen, I want to ask you about something else. Look, I started out by asking you about, you know, the limits of this. Sometimes it just doesn't seem to work. But look, especially with respect to just beliefs about the laws of nature or beliefs about facts or history, who did what, a man could become a cucumber. It's like almost anything goes, right? I don't resist. You say, you're the author, you say, imagine that objects travel faster than the speed of light. Imagine that one thing can be two places at once. I say, okay, you want me to imagine that, I will. But suppose you tried to say to me, imagine a person like who kills his infant child in cold blood for no apparent purpose. Now, I want you to imagine not only that he does it, but that it's morally correct that he does it, that it's a good thing that he does it. I'm like, whoa, I'm not going there. So sometimes we just won't go. And morality seems to be one of those places where we just won't go there with.
Yeah, but the question is, it's just occurring to me that one of the reasons you don't go there is because morality is the frame in some way, and the frame is actually being dismantled. Here, in the same way as you won't go there if you're in a normal realistic movie and suddenly turns into a science fiction movie. You're going to say, no, the frame, I'm not going to accept that. And the moral challenge there is actually challenging the frame that you're bringing to the situation.
Yeah, right, because one of the things one of the things we want fiction for is when you put these scenarios forth for my judging, for my evaluating morally. You say, that's a good guy, that's a bad guy, right? That was right, that was wrong. I mean, I'm rehearsing my moral sense in some mm-hmm. way when you ask. And to ask me to like...
You're enjoying that.
And I'm enjoying that. And to ask me and to like reconfigure that completely, what am I supposed to do? Like just have a new moral sense?
Well, that's and you're likely to say, no, I don't want to... That's too hard. Yeah. It's too hard.
Yeah. Bridget in Novato is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bridget.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Listening to your conversation, I'm hearing you're looking at this totally from the side of the perceiver, and you're not at all looking at the side of the artist.
Okay, tell us about the side of the artist.
Creating the work. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's
a good point,
for every
Bridget.
Piece of work, but it comes to mind right away. I was reading last night in Marcel Proust, when he's at the theater and he's watching Burma, who was, you know, Sarah Bernhardt, and he's saying that the experience that she gives him as an artist of Racine's text is completely different than that of the other people who are just saying words. I mean, I don't know if that has anything to do with anything, but I'm just interested that you're not at all talking about the skill or the craft or the gift or the mystery of whatever it is that is art, that actually the people who are creating works of art are...
I think that's a very good point, Bridget. Probably the explanation is that we're professors and not really creative artists, but it's certainly worth trying to take the artist's point of view.
And certainly, I think that's probably the subject of a whole show. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking today about art and the suspension of disbelief with our guest Stephen Meyer from Washington University of St. Louis.
You know, the willing suspension of disbelief, to use Coleridge's actual phrase, as one of our emailers pointed out, we apply that to art and fiction, but where else can we apply it? How about politics when we get involved in campaigns which deep down we know are utterly hopeless? Or love, or sports. How about all those Chicago Cubs fans? There must be some willing suspension of disbelief there. And after the break, we're going to kind of extend this concept. We want your opinion. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
How far can we apply the willing suspension of disbelief outside the context of fiction and art? We'll take your calls and answer that question when Philosophy Talk continues.
children always gather round. Mother Goose and all her rhyme, they fill the air with sounds of laughter.
Esther Satterfield and Chuck Mangione with The Land of Make-Believe. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing art and the suspension of disbelief. When does the concept of willing suspension of disbelief extend beyond art and fiction? What do you think? Give us a call, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
If you believe you're outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or finally, you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Stephen Meyer from Washington University in St. Louis. So we've been talking about art and movies and poetry and all that stuff, all that cool stuff. Let's think about real life. Does this concept have any application except to art, this willing suspension of disbelief?
No, that's one of the interesting things, that in fact, if you look at it, it looks as if it can serve, and it does serve, as a mediating tool when you have strong believers who disagree. So their beliefs are contrary beliefs. And you might just sort of throw up your arms and just say, there's no conversation possible here, because neither one of them is going to be willing to believe the other one's belief. But what if they're willing to suspend their disbelief? Is there an intermediate realm that can emerge? There are many examples of where this, but to take an example helps us also, I think, understand one of the previous questions. There's a movie that Werner Herzog made that had that came out this summer called Grizzly Man. Which was very controversial, and it was about Timothy Treadwell, who is probably better known on the West Coast than other parts of the country, who believed that he actually had a personal relationship with grizzly bears. And many people might be skeptical of this, or many people might say this is in fact true. And it's very hard to see how the two parties can talk about it. Mm-hmm. But Herzog was interested in this in this experience precisely because Treadwell left after he was killed by some grizzlies, which seems to be a clincher. Okay, yeah, it seems to be a clincher that in fact these are not your friends. But he left an enormous number of films of himself in a friendship position with bears. And what interested Herzog here is that although he didn't know whether this guy was a real artist or not, whether he was fully in control of the filming or not. He nevertheless, for Herzog, this almost unconscious art had art, and it enabled the suspension of disbelief. And you ask yourself, maybe it's possible.
You have a point. I mean, I think it's a good point. I used to tell my students that there's two games when you're arguing or thinking about something. There's two games you should play with the thing you're thinking about. There's the doubting game and the believing game. The doubting game is inspired by Descartes. Try to see what there is to be said against it. Try really hard. So don't be credulous, right? So that's when you're playing the doubting game. You're trying to disbelieve it or trying to undermine it. And Descartes taught us to do that well. But there's another game you need to play. Try believing it. Try seeing what there is to be said for it. Try it on as a possible belief. I think it's really important.
But the question is whether this is, in fact, the believing game or whether this is something else.
It's kind of the first step, I think. If you've got something you really can't believe but you want to be fair to the person who's putting it forward, the first step maybe is the kind of suspension of disbelief. That doesn't mean you quit disbelieving it. It means you somehow put that aside for the sake of argument. I'm also interested in kind of the case where you do it to yourself. I mean, I remember in 1968 working in California, in Santa Monica, until maybe, 9 o'clock at night when the polls closed, trying to get people to the polls to vote for one candidate rather than another. this was really a stupid thing to do from an objective point of view, because the election had clearly been decided. And as a matter of fact, when I finally got home to our post-election party, which wasn't a very happy one, I wasn't at all surprised to find out that they'd known the solution for an hour or two. And then I sometimes wonder where my whole life, at least politically speaking, isn't involved deeply in this willing suspension of disbelief that things could possibly turn out the way I wanted.
Jim in San Francisco on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jim. You there, Jim?
Yeah, hi.
What's your comment or question?
Just listening to your conversation, it reminded me of a passage in W.V. Quine's autobiography where he speaks about reading poetry.
And that passage, what does he say about that?
He says that often passages of poetry move him to great emotion, but then he goes on to say, so therefore, characteristically, I read very little of it.
That's Willard Van Orman Quine, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. And I wouldn't have guessed he was a great poetry reader.
No, but that's a long story. Dahl in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dahl.
Thank you. And thank you for not thinking that anybody's stupid who calls or whatever you said before. prejudging our intelligence, I mean. I was just thinking about when I was a child, my brother and I were constantly looking around for murderers, suspects, because, I don't know, my parents told us stories, and so we thought almost every third grown-up was a murderer. So we would always be discussing, do you think they did it or they did it? And we suspended our disbelief just about everybody.
Did you live in that little town that Angela Lansbury lives in New England, where practically every third person is a murderer? I mean,
no, I grew up in Mississippi, but it's pretty much the same ratio there, I think. But also, I was going to mention that this movie called The Story of Adele H. It's about Victor Hugo's daughter, and it's a true story. And I rented that movie the other night, and she suspended disbelief about this soldier not being in love with her, and it was really tragic, you know, very sad. But the last thing I was going to say, I think scientists suspend disbelief, political scientists suspend disbelief about the greenhouse effect until, you know, it's going to be too late, and then everybody will have to not suspend disbelief.
Thanks, Dahl. It raises some interesting questions. Look, we were talking about the role of suspension of disbelief outside of fiction, right, where the purpose there is to enable you to have some kind of emotional engagement with the thing. But look, sometimes in a real-life situation, if you suspend disbelief, you're being credulous, right? I mean, what's the difference between suspending disbelief and just an indefensible credulity.
Or even, as in the case of the greenhouse effect, maybe a certain amount of self-deception where you just kind of bracket off the evidence and don't draw the conclusions.
And, I'm almost speechless at this, so I'm going to pass the buck on this one.
Well, so tell me, what's the difference? What's the difference between mere credulity and a reasonable suspension of disbelief? Is there any test we could have for that? I mean, anything we could say?
One of the things, because one of the interesting things here, this last caller, she's describing a character in a movie suspending disbelief in this guy in order to continue being interested in him. And that's, in fact, the thing about suspending disbelief is that it encourages interest.
Right.
But sometimes interest isn't a good thing. That's sort of close to your morality question, that sometimes it turns out not to have been a good thing.
Well, I would say part of it is that, as we mentioned before, when you suspend disbelief, you also usually at the same time suspend your proneness to act on the basis of the things suspension in disbelief of which you're doing,
or however to put it.
Yeah. So, but I think it's a mistake to suspend your disbelief, but let your action be unoffended. That seems to me to get into self-deception. So, if you're going to suspend your belief, stay in the fantasy world.
Yeah.
Suspending your disbelief to get along with somebody, then once you're not worried about getting along with that person, you better go back to being rational in terms of what you actually believe.
Right. I tell my students, try believing some things that you find hard to believe. Try them on, right? Turn off your skeptical hat. I mean, I think that's a key to advancing knowledge. So I don't think it's just about fantasy world, but I also agree that there is a difference between credulity and self-deception on the one hand and rational suspension of disbelief on the other.
Now, Ken, next time we talk about my philosophy of language, I want you to remember this business about turning off or about suspending your disbelief.
So, Stephen, I'll give you, we're getting to the end of our time with you. You have any last thoughts you want to share with us?
Well, let me just say one thing, which is that the fact that this notion emerged in discussions of poetry, and it has left discussions of poetry, not a bad thing, but at the same time, poetry has sort of gone underground. And so whether actually talking about suspension of disbelief and understanding how it works at large is in fact possibly a way of also seeing how poetry works at large in areas that we don't normally think of poetry as having a place.
So on that thought, I have to thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure having you.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Our guest has been Stephen Meyer, Associate Professor of English at Washington University in St. Louis, author of Irresistible Dictation, Gertrude Stein, and the Correlations of Writing and Science. And we also need to thank the Stanford Humanities Center, who made Stephen's visit to us possible today.
And we also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to and the emailers whose email we didn't get a chance to read.
Yeah, there was a whole lineup of callers and emails. Thanks everybody out there for all the contributions. So, John, what do you think? Where's your mind on this stuff now?
Well, I think actually we do have one email here that's very interesting from a man named Iwe who talks about Coleridge and says that the Romantics were it was very important to them that we view emotions and imaginations as central human experiences and not be over intellectual and over rational. And I think as philosophers, it's easy to forget that. I think they are a central aspect. And I think that one of our emailers or callers earlier on who said, well, maybe in the drabness of ordinary existence, we don't get enough of an emotional fix. I think that's probably true.
I wanted to say to Pete there, even if we lived in the grandest of times, I still think imagination outstrips reality and reveals new possibilities to us, you know, that reality doesn't display. And so even if we were in the morally perfect world and all this sort of stuff, there would still be the adventures of the imagination. So I'm not quite sure that it's the mere drabness that makes us hungry for fictional worlds and all that.
Well, how about people who lead terribly exciting, painful, distressful lives? Do they like to read fiction about people who get up in the morning and have a nice day and go to bed and don't have any trouble sleeping? I wonder.
That's a good question. That's an empirical question, as they say. Now, look, again, the one thing that I'm still a little puzzled about is we didn't talk enough about it. I don't know the answer. Morality. Why is it that anything goes with respect to the facts? You're the author. You invite me to imagine an alternative world. You invite me to imagine a world in which good is bad, in which evil, you know, what I think of as evil isn't evil. I'm not going to go there easily. You know, I think that's an interesting question.
To wrap up our conversation on art and suspension of disbelief, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, regarding the concept of the willing suspension of disbelief, J.R.R. Tolkien once wrote, "The notion that motor cars are more alive than, say, centaurs or dragons is curious. That they are more real than, say, horses is pathetically absurd." Tolkien was a philologist at Oxford, a Catholic and good friends with the devout Anglican and fantasy writer C.S. Lewis, creator of the Chronicles of Narnia. The two, both huge fans of Norse myth, once had an intense all-night conversation in which Tolkien argued for both the literal and mythological truth of the resurrection of Christ. C.S. Lewis at one point said that myths are lies breathed through silver, causing Tolkien to ask how Lewis could accept Icelandic sagas as revealing a higher truth, but not the Gospels. Tolkien was working on Lord of the Rings at the time and developing his own theories of fiction that were set forth in his 1947 essay On Fairy Stories. There, he defined fairy stories as not being so much about fairies, but about fairy, the realm where fairies and their ilk have their being, the realm of hobbits, orcs, elves, and trolls. In a true fairy story, magic must be taken seriously, neither laughed at nor explained away. Thus, Alice in Wonderland or Wizard of Oz are not true fairy stories because they turn out to be dreams. The land of fairy, for Tolkien, is not a dream, but a real place with real magic. He gave fairy stories four elements: fantasy, endowing unreal things with the consistency of reality; recovery, the regaining of a clear view, implying that we once had a clear view but lost it; escape, so-called reality is not inevitable, even if magical alternatives seem impossible; and consolation, the happy ending, or in the word he coined, the eucatastrophe, a moment of joy at deliverance from evil. But Tolkien wrote, "The realm of fairy story is wide and deep and high and filled with many things. And while the reader is there, it is dangerous for him to ask too many questions, lest the gate should be shut and the keys be lost." In other words, the success of a fairy story depends not upon a suspension of disbelief, but upon total faith in its reality. In that sense, the fairy story was an echo of his deep Christian faith. The ultimate happy ending for a Christian is the resurrection of Christ. As he wrote in a poem to C.S. Lewis, "Though all the crannies of the world we filled with elves and goblins, though we dared to build gods in their houses out of dark and light, and sowed the seed of dragons, 'twas our right, used or misused, that right has not decayed. We make still, by the law in which we're made. The fairy story, therefore, is created with the same laws used by God to create us. Whether reading Lord of the Rings is a true substitute for church gone, well, don't ask me. That's between you and your maker. I gotta go.
Wow, Ken, my head is dizzy from 60 seconds of rapid-fire philosophy.
If your head is dizzy, that means you've got a conundrum in your mind, and we can solve it for you, can't we, John?
Yes. Go to our webpage,
conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or hit that conundrums button on the webpage. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Rujun Shen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW.